The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
Kazaa! Benny!
I have one operating room. It's the weekend, so there's only one operating room going. And it just became available, and it's first come, first serve. In other words, there were other people in the same hospital who, if they had had a candy striper, get them into the operating room sooner, would have gotten served before my brother would have died. And the nurse, knowing how badly off he was, made a point of getting him in there before someone else could get the room. Now, that should never be the status of our healthcare system. But it is, because the government has set up a system with rationed healthcare. I just want to explain what that means. It's not, you know, just saying, oh, they do a poor job. It literally means by design, they ration the amount because they don't want to pay more than, right now it already consumes 2/3 of the Ontario budget. Like all the money that's coming in, 2/3 of it's just going to healthcare alone. Why? Because if you say ice cream's free, everyone will want some, you know. You'll have an ice cream budget that blows out the entire budget if you would make it free. If you had food care, the same thing would happen. It would take up the majority of the budget. Why? Because everyone wants a roast, you know, every night, and a jug of ice cream, and, you know, 6 gallons of pop and all the other crap. So they made a system that's free, so-called free, which means it's just paid for by people who earn money and pay taxes, but not by people who don't earn money and don't pay taxes. Although even some of them pay taxes whenever they buy something at the store, you know, sales taxes. And because it was getting so expensive, they said, what can we do? This is back in Ray days, like in the 1990s. They said, well, premiers get together because they're all experiencing the same problem. They've all socialized and made a government monopoly of their healthcare systems. They've all banned private healthcare, banned private insurance, banned private provision of healthcare services because they think socialism sells. And it does, right? Clearly, a majority wanted something for nothing, and they got it. But what they really got was nothing for nothing. And I believe it was 90 or 92, they came up with the great idea of, well, one way to provide, to keep the costs under control is to limit the number of physicians. So we will put a cap on the number of people who can study medicine and get a license to practice medicine in the province. And if there's only so many physicians, there's only so many mouths to feed. So that's, we got shortages of physicians, shortages of nurses. They don't want the provision of healthcare. It costs too much, right? They know it does. If they had doctors, if they had more doctors, more services, they'd have a bigger cost to pay. But it's already swallowing most of the budget. No one wants to admit that the system is broken by design, that it was never meant to provide. In fact, there's a video, a Freedom Party video we've produced. I think it's called From the Horse's Mouth. And because Tommy Douglas, the Western socialist, father of Canadian medicine, right? Canadian socialized medicine, admits, he explains, look, when we said we have to socialize medicine, it was never the case that we were suggesting that we move to a system where whenever you got sick or injured, you'd get service. That's impossible. He admits this. He says this. So watch the video. And this is not me. This is Tommy Douglas spearheading the move toward this system where they cannot help all the sick and injured. He says, what we wanted was preventative medicine. Now, preventative medicine and mandatory vaccinations kind of go hand in hand, don't they? In other words, it's a socialist idea. Let's try and prevent people from needing healthcare by shooting them full of things that may or may not help. Because communists ain't got the cash to pay for the system that they thought was so great. And that's all we've got. We've got a system that is designed for preventative maintenance, not for dealing with everyone's needs when they get ill, sick and injured. The sick and injured in these provinces, in Canada, largely are, if you're really sick, but repairable, you might go to the front of the line. If you're really sick, but it's doubtful to be able to do much for you, you're a lost cause. If you're not particularly sick, you can wait. And if you might be sick, we don't want to know yet. So we're going to put you on a delay list for diagnosis. Because if we had to find out that you have cancer or whatever it is, then we owe you this healthcare. Yeah. But if we don't know you're sick, plausible deniability. And that's what we've got. And it's driving, Robert, this entire mask up, lockdown, shoot your stuff full of, it's all of the socialists trying to save the healthcare system. They aren't even saying to save people. They literally say in their press conferences, we have to save the healthcare system, the system. They're not saving people. They're saving the socialist system. From what? From embarrassment. That's what they're saving it from. They don't want people to realize that it's not financially sound.
It's not a healthcare system. It is a sick care system.
Well, that's what a healthcare system should be, care for the sick. But instead, all it does, all it's designed to do, is shoot you full of things that hopefully will keep you from getting sick. Although they never seem to take anything that really makes you sick seriously. You know, obesity or what have you. I mean, obesity is through the roof. And it's no mistake that the people most affected by coronavirus infection, like the ones who get seriously ill, are the ones who are obese or have diabetes, and those two things go together. So, you know, I'm not saying government should be telling people to exercise. That's not the role of government. But it also isn't the role of government to form a healthcare system that doesn't provide any health care, that just prevents people from getting sick, or that hopes to prevent people so that it will never be called upon to actually remediate anybody's problems.
I would like to welcome on the show Kevin, and he is our whistleblower Canadian paramedic. We do know, I do have a share up there, that there have been about 10,000 people that have been let go. If you see that there, I'll kind of move it. True North reported on this. I love True North. Provinces sacked almost 10,000 healthcare workers, and it's probably more than that, I think. Thank you for being on the show. I wonder if you could begin by telling us a little bit about yourself. What's led you to this place where you feel you have to be so honest?
Well, I've been a paramedic for in excess of 30 years. That's a third of a century. And I have never seen the kind of things that I've seen in the last couple of years. And in some of the provinces, I found out that they've even taken off some of the immediate intervention equipment like CPAP and Ventolin that we give to patients. And these are critical medications, because they're saying that, well, we're afraid that we would aerosolize these medications and thus create a risk to the crew and other people. But in, as I say, almost a third of a century, I've never seen anybody get sick by using PPE safely. It's just not what happens. Whereas now, we're arbitrarily assuming that everyone is sick, even though they have no symptoms, and we're taking them in perhaps for their normal medical concerns that we, you know, seen them before in the past. But we're withholding life-giving medications and treatments and procedures from them. And even when they get to the hospital, if they're given a diagnosis of from a PCR test, a COVID or something like that, then the way they're even treated at the hospital changes. I just been watching this for the last few years, and it just really hurts to see patients not treated properly and seeing paramedics not being able to do their jobs properly. So in a major metropolitan station where you're doing typically, you know, you figure, you know, 15 to 20 minutes out to the house, maybe 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes on scene, depending on what type of scene it is, then back to a hospital with a, again, metropolitan wait times are between, you know, 1 and 2 or 3 hours sometimes, depending on the call volume. So you're in a 12-hour shift. You know, we're working in a major metropolitan city. I'll keep that out of there. But we're typically doing 7 to 9 calls a day, even with those think about those travel times. That's almost a nonstop day shift. And the night's not quite as busy, but they're still busy. So as soon as this so-called pandemic hit, we went down, and I've been in this city particularly for quite a few years now. We went down from, as I say, 7 to 9 calls minimum. If you took a mean average throughout the year, we went down to 1 and sometimes 2 calls a day. 0 calls sometimes at night.
Wow.
And as evidence worldwide, all around the world, people themselves have been going into hospitals, car parks, going walking through Emerge and various places and filming for the next several months that they're empty. And that's what we experienced. I mean, the major center that I work in, our Emerge, I have never seen it in the last, I won't quantify the time, but over the last multiple years, I have never seen it with less than at least 14 to 18 people. Sometimes the overflow goes right through into other departments, down into the medical imaging and various other areas where they can store some extra people. And there's 60 people waiting there, and their average wait times, depending on the urgency, and even if it's relatively urgent, they, you know, of course they try to triage them, but they can only deal with volume. But, you know, there's typical wait times for something like, you know, a badly cut hand or something like this. You're looking at 3 to 5 to 6 hours. So suddenly these rooms are empty. You know, there might be one solitary patient sitting in there in the evening waiting for the doctor.
You're listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. And Kevin was actually a whistleblower from Ontario, completely confirming our own observations made as long ago as early 2020 by our own personal whistleblowers.
Now, the Conservative Party has been getting rid of any opposition within their ranks. And these disaffected progressive conservatives have started their own parties, some of them. Baber, for example, has not. He's just sitting as an independent. But the others have, Randy Hillier, Jim and Belinda Kariolis, and Trillium Party's Bob Yatsiuk.
They came from a previous wave of opportunism. So
sure, they started in 2014. They're still on the books, so I don't know if they're going to run any candidates or not.
Yeah, if I recall correctly, that was a pet project by someone out there formed this Trillium Party, and Jack McLaren had gotten kicked out of the PC caucus. We always see this. Anybody who voices any opposition to any form of socialism gets kicked out of the PC caucus eventually. So Jack McLaren got kicked out. He knew he wouldn't be getting the PC nomination, so they offered him the leadership of the Trillium Party. Jack seemed to be a good guy, and he was one of the Ontario landowner rabble-rousers, if you want to call it that.
Oh, with Randy Hillier, yeah.
With Randy Hillier. And so, you know, it made sense. And the interesting thing about Randy is, you know, his heart's in the right place. He's not really a pro-freedom guy.
That's what I wanted to ask you about. That's what I was leading up to, is that none of them have freedom in the name of their party.
No, and there's a reason for that. Well, there's a reason also why they don't just join Freedom Party.
Yeah, well, I know that.
Because, yeah, they're not in favor of individual freedom. That's not really what they're in favor of. They want freedom from the mask mandate or freedom from the lockdowns, right?
A particular issue.
Yeah, yeah. They're opposed to something. Mm-hmm. So if they're opposed to something, they want to be free of it. In that sense, they're a Freedom Party. But it's not. But they're not for individual freedom as any person would normally define it. Randy has stood up for things like, I remember there was a bill proposed by the Liberals. I think it went through. And I think Jack McLaren was the only one to stand up and oppose it. It was a bill that said you can't come within so far of a abortion clinic with a sign objecting. So it was against expression, objecting to abortion. Jack McLaren voted against. Randy Hillier did not show up for the vote. That's kind of strange if you want to be an advocate of free speech, to not speak up against a law that would limit free speech, right? But if you look at what Randy has proposed in the legislature for, like, private members' bills and that kind of thing, usually they're about procedure. So he wants accountability, transparency, one member, one vote. In fact, it's really funny that he would want to start a political party at all, because he's against them. He does not like party discipline. He doesn't want a leader that sets up party policy and requires the members who traded their independence for the nomination of the party. I mean, that's what you do. You say, I'm an MPP or I want to be an MPP, but I don't think I can get in without the support, the endorsement of a major party. So I am going to enter into agreement where I will support the party's policies if they will give me the endorsement. That's what partisan politics is. It's saying the party's going to be the decision maker. I'm going to add my voice to the party so that we can push through the party's program. And Hillier's always been against towing the party line. He's been kicked out, I think, by Tim Hudak when Hudak was the leader. He's been kicked out of caucus now, out of the party, by Doug Ford, as has Belinda Karahelios. The Karahelioses are famously, if you go to the LifeSite news site, they're basically portrayed as a pro-life couple. So that's what they're about. They're the social conservatives who are trying to push through their agenda and who feel, again, they're about procedure, because they're under the impression that the party is not allowing them to use the party to push their policies.
So they started another party.
Well, interestingly, if you look at what Jim Karahalios said about why he started New Blue, he said, well, they told Belinda, who wants the nomination for 2022, the Progressive Conservative nomination, and he wanted to be the leader of the federal conservatives. I don't know if he threw his name in the hat for the provincial conservatives, but he's always been involved. Because they told her, you will not get the nomination. We're not allowing you to have the nomination. He says, quote unquote, we had no option but to form our own party because Belinda won't get the PC nomination.
If you watch their videos on their website and their Twitter feed, all I get, my own impression, personal impression about this, is that they are two people with an axe to grind against the blue machine. Federally and provincially. They really have no policies other than their social conservatism, progressive conservatism policies, and they are not a real contender in the field of ideas. They have no ideas.
No, and in fact, that's the funny thing about these parties, like in particular Ontario First Party, which is the Randy Hillier Vanity Project, and then the New Blue. Neither party has ever had a slate of candidates. Neither party has ever participated in an election. Neither party has ever had an election platform.
Ontario First Party, by the way, the name is not even registered yet.
Yeah. He has to get on the ballot, though. It's pretty simple now. What they do is they just allow anybody to form a party. This is to create a lot of white noise, right? So that new parties are difficult to find, legitimate ones. And so they just flood the field with as many new parties as possible so that hopefully the Progressive Conservatives, the Liberals, and the NDP don't face any competitors. That no one's aware that there are competitors. There's just those three and then white noise. That's the way they changed the electoral system or the party aspect of it. That was the Liberals who changed it. And that was due to a constitutional challenge, actually, because at the time, provincial parties were forced to pay $200 per candidate in a province with over 100 ridings, 100 candidates. So you would have to have, you know, considerable amount of money raised by the candidate typically, just to get on the ballot. Well, that was unconstitutional. And so they said, well, there's only like six or seven parties in the province right now. There were the PCs, Liberal, NDP, Green, Libertarian, Freedom Party, and maybe, I think there was the Family Coalition Party at one point. And that was the social conservative offshoot of the PCs. There's always a social conservative offshoot of the PCs, right? The people are just a little bit too religiously motivated for the progressive conservatives to think they can win if they use their policies. Yeah, you went from an Ontario with like six or seven parties to an Ontario with like 25 or 27 or 29.
23 registered right now, I counted just before we met.
Okay, there you go. Yeah, and more to come because of the ones that are
reserved,
yeah. All they have to do, I think, is run two candidates and they get to be on the rosters.
Anyway, you were saying that they have no electoral history, not like the Freedom Party.
Nothing. There's no history that would demonstrate to anybody that they're actually in favor of individual freedom. If you look at what they've done as politicians, you can see on the Karahalios side, like you say, people are just resentful of the party machinery. And even in Randy Hillier's case, again, resentful of the party machinery, which he thinks would be resolved if the party could not whip votes, right? If it was one member, one vote, in which case you don't even need a political party, because everyone is just running as an independent and doing what they want. And that's fine. You might think that's fine, okay? But the whole constitution in Canada, the whole reason that we make as premier the leader of the party having won the most seats, we don't elect the premier. The premier is appointed by the Queen's representative, by the lieutenant governor, right? And the rule used, the constitutional rule used is count up the number of winners in each party. Whichever party has the greatest number of winners, number of MPPs, the leader of that party becomes the premier, just appointed by the Queen. Same thing federally. The prime minister is appointed by the Queen. And when the premier or the prime minister is appointed, they then recommend to the Queen's representative, the governor general or the lieutenant governor general, who should be cabinet ministers. And then they're all appointed. So we don't elect the government. The government is the cabinet.
And as a matter of fact, they can, the leader, the premier and the prime minister can actually appoint non-sitting people to the cabinet. And it has been done.
Yeah. You don't need to be elected to be in the government. You have to be elected to be a lawmaker. to be in the legislature, but not to be making regulations, because that's where regulations are made, in government, not in the legislature. The regulations include, for example, all those regulations that have been made pursuant to Bill 195. So Bill 195 was the one that said, well, although the coronavirus pandemic has ended in, I think it was July of 2020, we're going to continue our emergency powers in the absence of an emergency, which is completely absurd, because it's all of these regulations that they then pass pursuant to Bill 195, the cabinet. They're basically saying, we don't need the legislature anymore. The cabinet's running the whole show. And that, of course, should upset everybody, right? Because our elected representatives have no power over the government. We're effectively being run by a handful of people, all of whom can thank, you know, another handful of very wealthy donors and connected people for their positions. We do not have elected parties even right now running this country.
As a matter of fact, Doug Ford has, if you ask me, Doug Ford has no say in what is going on in that party. I mean, he stands there like a deer caught in the headlights. Let me be perfectly clear that we are all in this together. Therefore, we must never get together.
Mayor McCheesecake, that's what he is at this point. He's a figurehead, you know. Let's face it. If anyone's ever heard the guy talk, you know he is not a particularly intelligent man. He's certainly not well-versed in governance. And, it's clear when he says we're taking our advice from the science table or from the experts in medicine and et cetera. What he's saying is, I've abandoned my post. I'm going to make them the decision makers. And if they make the wrong decisions, it's on them. It's not on me. Vote for me.
Today, we take a trip to our neighbor to the north, the country of Canada.
This is Truth to Ponder with Bob Bierman.
Now, my guest for today's program is Robert Metz. Now, one of the listeners to this program encouraged me to go to the website for a program called Just Right. And it is hosted by Robert Metz and others. And by the way, he is the founding member, one of the founding members of the Freedom Party of Ontario back in 1984, has been its president ever since. And I'm thoroughly certain that in that capacity, he's irritated a lot of the, shall we say, status quo. And I'm excited to have him on the program today because there's a lot happening with our neighbor to the north that really influences and means a lot to all of us in the United States. What happens in Canada, United States, it's going to happen in Australia, New Zealand, United Kingdom. We all have a shared heritage. We all have a shared responsibility. We're not even 10 and a half months into getting injected, and they're already talking about a fourth shot for people. This is ridiculous.
Yep.
And children.
Up here in Canada, we already know they're planning for 8 shots, and are in areas of Europe, and that story's already come out. Mm-hmm. Trudeau's ordered enough quote-unquote vaccines for 8 doses. And there have been some documents online uncovered that show that the vaccine passports, which are an obscenity, by the way,
absolutely,
are already predetermined to have 8 entries on them. They want to see each person with 8 of these jabs stuck into them.
Wow!
And you know, you mentioned
those that live to those that can make it through all 8 jabs.
And you know, you asked me an interesting question in one of our previous email exchanges. You asked, how is freedom being stolen in Canada? And, you know, I can't answer that question because I would say freedom is never stolen. It's always given up. And, pardon the pun, given up freely.
Yeah, and that you're very true. I ran into something I shared on the program earlier this week that really was kind of an eye-opener when you understand how people can be persuaded to become followers. You know, you would assume that you've got to have the majority of the people behind you, a majority. The truth is, you don't.
The only thing I can say is my personal experience is that I'm definitely being persecuted by my regulatory body just for the mere fact of asking questions and exploring other options of comprehensively managing patients during this pandemic, to the extent that my college has suspended my license. So as I'm sitting here, I'm a suspended physician without a license to be able to do my job as a physician in this pandemic while I was on the front line as an ER physician. It means that I think people that are willing to question the narrative is a challenge to them at this moment. If they haven't seen into the future, where some of us are actually willing to take it further and say, we're not going to back down. Even though we are in a court battle at this moment, we are going to fight even harder now to create that parallel system, because it's not just for us, it's for us as well as our children in the future. And you're absolutely correct with that graph that you posted there. For many years, we've known of Canadians traveling to the States, traveling to the Cayman Islands, to traveling to the Caribbean, to Mexico, to get extra medical services that they were willing to pay for. So it's easy for us to think that healthcare is free in Canada. If there's anything that this pandemic has taught us in the last year and a half, 2 years, it's absolutely not been free. In fact, the price has been very high for the healthcare system that we've got. Because the problem is, if you only have one healthcare system, who is in control of that healthcare system? Who controls the funding of that healthcare system? The state and the government. Which means they have total control of what is done in those facilities, which includes family health teams as well as hospitals.
So clearly they anticipate at least 8 doses. This idea that 2 and you're done, or 1 and you're done, well, 3 and you're done, maybe 4. No one said 5 yet, give it a month. And, you know, I'm really concerned that the literature coming out now on the damage being done by these things, damage to people's hearts, people's vision, neurological conditions. These aren't fakeries. These aren't so rare that we could ignore them. They are more predominant than the deaths from this Omicron. I mean, they had
there has been no deaths by Omicron.
Right, and 1,000 people with tested positive, so they get called a case, even though they're perfectly healthy and they're not feeling ill. And only 2 of them ended up having to get hospitalized. And hospitalized doesn't mean they were in the ICU. It just means they went to the hospital, you know. So the whole thing is so overblown. It seems to be the case that the college for the physicians and surgeons has basically said, if you don't toe the line, Mr. Physician or Madam Physician, your license is in jeopardy. So we don't really have independent doctors right now. We have a politicized system where physicians will not. It was the exact same thing, you'll recall. In the year 2000, the Supreme Court of Canada said that the medical use of cannabis, so there were all kinds of different things people were using cannabis for, visual impairments, physical pain, that kind of stuff. Well, the charter, according to the charter, the Supreme Court of Canada said, no, the medical use of cannabis is perfectly acceptable. Laws against it are invalid. Great. How do you prove that you're using it medically? Oh, we have to go to a physician. What does the physician do? The physician gives you a certificate that says, yes, he needs to consume cannabis for his glaucoma or what have you. How do you get one of those? Well, the physicians would not give you one. Why not? Because their college was saying there haven't been enough studies. It's the ivermectin thing all over again, okay? There haven't been enough studies. There's no control group. We don't know exactly what the effect is. If you give someone a prescription for cannabis, you could lose your license. In other words, we'll take your license away. Well, who was promoting that? It wasn't the, you know, medical arm of the College of Physicians and Surgeons. It's obviously the pharmaceutical industry, who stands to lose billions of dollars when people start using relatively cheap and things they can grow in their own living room, you know, to take care of ailments and whatnot, when they could instead be buying from Pfizer or whoever some pill that costs $100 a whack. You know, it's always been the same. If there's a cheap alternative, outlaw it. Say it's dangerous. If it's effective or more effective, then we really have to defame it. We have to say it's dangerous, it's untested, there's no control group. So that's your ivermectin, your hydroxychloroquine, all these various things. I'm not an expert, but we've had physicians, legitimate physicians, experts in their own field, come out and say they've been having great success with X, Y, or Z. And reflexively, these governing bodies have said, doctors, if you do any of these things, in other words, if you try to remediate the harm that's done by the virus, instead of preventing the harm by having everyone injected with a experimental mRNA technology, you could lose your license. You can't even question it. You can't even cast any doubt on the effectiveness of this vaccine. It's far too important that we get everybody on board.
What would the Freedom Party of Ontario do to combat such a takeover of the medical profession by bureaucrats and politicians?
For example, should we have these limits on how many physicians there are anymore? Isn't there something that needs to be investigated or discussed or looked at there? And perhaps it will find its way onto a Freedom Party election platform in 2022? Should there not be some sort of review of everything that's been done to Ontarians over the last 2 years by elected and unelected individuals? Should they all get a pass for everything they've done, for all the harm they've caused? What about all the people who've been fined? I can tell you right now, someone gives me the power to fix these things. Well, some people are going to have a really bad morning the next day, and others are going to be jumping for joy. And I'll just leave you with that, and you'll see where the platform takes you as we get closer to June 2022. And I'll be very happy, and you will be too, if you cast your vote in favor of Freedom Party.
Well, I know I'll be happy when I cast my vote for Freedom Party. I haven't wasted a single vote since I've been able to do so. Now, I can't predict the future or what will happen in 2022. Some of the issues we'll still be facing and which have to be addressed in the new year will include Donald Trump's bizarre support for the so-called vaccines and the criticism he's now facing from his own support base, something we have to talk about. And of course, we'll have to continue to comment on COVID developments, and with both an Ontario election and midterms in the US to steal a bit of our attention in 2022, we of course will always be covering those events and issues in a way that's just right, through the eyes of the philosopher of reason. And who knows what science, quote-unquote, our politicians, quote-unquote, will be following as they pretend to lead us into the Great Reset. Have you noticed lately how politicians claim to be making their decisions on science, while doctors and scientists tell us that they're being forced to practice their professions based on politics? Well, whatever happens in the new year, they tell us that we're all in this together. So let's get together again next year, shall we? Starting 1 week from today, when we will continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be all right.
I don't approve of anybody who sells out to the Nazis.
Please believe me. No matter how guilty I may seem, I have never betrayed my country.
I'd like to believe that.
Yes, I did research for them.
You call that intelligent?
Wait until they test their precious radar tomorrow, darling, and you'll find out how brilliant I really am. You see, in science, it's not the research that counts. It's how you use it.
I wonder if Einstein started this way.